Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And on this episode, we're going to be discussing the new remake of the film Suspiria. This project has apparently been in the works for, in one form or another, for about 10 years or more, hasn't it, Matt?
Yeah, I was literally just looking at this. It was going to land in David Gordon Green's lap, director of the recent Halloween sequel in 2008, but it fell through for whatever reason. It was directed by Luca Guadagnino, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah.
In any case, we're on a first-name basis, Luca and I, so I don't have to butcher his surname any more than absolutely necessary. We're pretty tight. His most high-profile work was last year's Call Me By Your Name, which is kind of a critical darling. I think Suspiria has been more divisive, but I liked it quite a bit. I think we both did. So we're going to dive in here. It's going to be a difficult one to talk about because it's definitely the densest movie we've looked at on this show. And there's more, for me at least, attendant anxiety there because you don't want to sound like a fool. You don't want to have missed some glaring subtextual thing that'll get you laughed out of all the snooty film critic parties. But it does function in terms of like a bare bones horror story. It's a very slow burn, but I think even without all of the kind of art house dressing, it's a very functional little horror movie. I say little, it's actually 2.5 hours long, although I thought it was a pretty brisk viewing experience. I don't know if that was...
Yeah, no, it moved along at a very good clip. It really didn't feel like 2.5 hours.
Yeah, which... there's a kind of constantly broiling sense of unease, even when there's nothing especially troubling happening right in front of your eyes. There's a sense of things happening just around the corner that you wouldn't want to get a close look at.
And it's really for, I felt like, at least 2/3 of the movie's runtime that I remarked upon this to Matt while we were driving back from the movie theater. For about 2/3 of the movie, I was thinking to myself, you know, this isn't really like a horror movie per se. And then then Luca, as we've come to know the man,
your friend and mine, Luca,
sort of he must have you know, my mouth to God's ears, so to speak. He heard that and went, nope, this is definitely a horror movie.
Yeah, and Jim was left thoroughly chastened because the last 20 minutes are balls to the wall insane. In terms of 2018 releases, I'd liken it to something like Mandy. It's like that caliber of
you know,
splatterhouse craziness.
Mandy also occurred to me, so I'm glad we both had that thought.
Yeah, yeah. I watched it within the past week or two, so the connection was inescapable for me at least. So, Suspiria, it is a remake, or more of an homage, to I think is how Luca pitched it, to 70s Italian horror classic by Dario Argento. Dario and I aren't so close, so I'm going to call him Mr. Argento from now on. We had a falling out some time ago. I'm a big fan of Suspiria. It's a giallo movie, meaning, well, it's something of an outlier in the genre. Giallo movies, it was an Italian horror subgenre. Its key features are lurid depictions of violent, bloody death, garish color schemes, lots of bold primary colors, really the brighter the better. They're movies that really pop, and they depict horrifying things in beautiful ways, which sort of traps the audience into like wanting to look away but also wanting to get a closer look because it's pretty and repulsive at the same time. That was sort of their appeal, I think. And it also told a very kind of archetypal, simple story, sort of a fairy tale kind of story. It's a lot of, I know that Snow White, Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was on Mr. Argento's mind when he was making it. It was filmed within like 3-strip Technicolor. So it looks not just like colorful, but like really rich colors that you associate with classic Hollywood or with, you know, old school Disney animation. And it's got that kind of fairy tale sensibility running all the way through it. New film couldn't be further from that. It is both very drab looking. It's a sumptuous film, but the color palette is grayish, and gray sad. Brown. It's very like Soviet bloc kind of colors.
Which
lots of concrete, lots of snow.
It stands to reason because it's set in Cold War divided Berlin.
Yes,
East Berlin specifically. So you know a lot of shots of the wall. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of political subtext, yep, and lots just of, straight text.
Lots of unrest in the streets, which is, you know, usually happening around the periphery of the story, just kind of just outside of the frame.
Yeah, a lot of Bader Meinhof stuff.
Right. So whereas the original Suspiria was a very colorful fairy tale, this is a kind of colorless political allegory. It's the exact inverse of both of those qualities while telling the same story and telling it really well, I think. So the story that they both tell in its simplest terms is about an American, I think in the original she was a ballet student. She's a dancer in any case. In the new Suspiria, it's more modern dance, more a little bit more avant-garde. I'm not an expert.
Nor I. Yeah, we'll try.
Yeah, well, I won't. in the original and in both versions, an American dancer named Susie Banyan comes to a European dance academy and begins to catch on to the fact that sinister forces are at work there. It's a front for a coven of witches who are sacrificing the dancers under their tutelage and using them to abet their dark arts in some way. And presiding over the coven is an ancient old crone named Helena Marcos, who is called referred to as the Mother of Sighs, or Mater Suspiriorum, I think.
Yes.
Which is where the title of the film is derived from, Suspiria. And the end of both films, well, we'll get there when we get there. I don't want to. So in the Argento, Mr. Argento, my apologies, made three of these movies, Three Mothers Trilogy, it's called. Each one about a different witch, a different mater, who, yeah, presided over different nefarious goings-ons.
Yeah, so there's Suspiria, obviously.
Yep.
That's what we're talking about.
That's the first one, 77.
77, followed in 1980 by Inferno,
mm-hmm,
which is about the mother of darkness, Mater. Oh boy, my Latin's failing me.
Jim, no, this is supposed to be your specialty.
I'm sorry. It's the mother of darkness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hop on Google Translate. You can get it in Latin. It'll probably be 80% right.
I'm sure that Mr. Argento did more or less the same thing. Probably had like a Latin compendium open in his lap instead.
Well, you know, he's Italian. He probably just walked up to the Vatican, something like that.
I don't think Mr. Argento is welcome at the Vatican. I'm almost positive he's been forcibly ejected from it. It just seems like something he would do.
Yeah. But in any case, that one's about the Mother of Darkness. I won't go into detail about the plot, but Inferno is also pretty good. It's not quite on the level of Suspiria, but it's definitely enjoyable. It's,
mm-hmm,
it's got a lot of good stuff going on. And then fast forward 29 more years.
2007, was it?
9, I think.
Okay.
It might have been 2007, but either way, it was at least a quarter century later. And our buddy Dario, Mr. Argento, got the urge to complete the trilogy. And
which, so, I'm glad he did, because it would suck just not having a third entry.
Yeah, and this one's called The Mother of Tears, which in Latin is Mater Lacrimosum. I remembered that one.
Which sounds scarier than Mother of Tears, I think. I mean, they both sound pretty imposing, but...
Yeah.
Yeah,
and incidentally, Asia Argento, Dario's daughter, is the lead in Mother of Tears. And unfortunately for both Argentos, that film is really not very good at all.
No, it's pretty... I remember it being pretty incoherent and unsatisfying. And it's... I don't know. Yeah. I think, again, not sorry it exists. I'm glad there's three of them, just so you can assess them as a trilogy the way they were intended. But yeah, it doesn't measure up. And the new Suspiria, I don't anticipate getting any sequels. I think it's going to be a one and done affair.
The new Suspiria is much longer than the first one. It's got more moving parts. It introduces some new characters, one of whom we meet right off the bat. The film opens with a distraught dancer from the Sinister Academy. I think it's called the Helena Marcos Dance Institute or something like that.
Something along those lines.
It's definitely got Helena Marcos in the title. And as in the first Suspiria, she's kind of built up over the course of the movie. She's an unseen menace. So this dancer, who's a nervous wreck, shows up at the home of an elderly man named Professor Klemperer. And she's been confiding in him about her troubles and her suspicions regarding the academy. She's become convinced that it is what it is, which is a front for a coven of witches. And she looks like a crazy person, and Klemperer assesses her accordingly. He thinks that the academy is up to no good, but he thinks that it has a perfectly mundane explanation and that the supernatural stuff is all just projection on his patient's part.
Yeah, I mean, she, in addition to just like looking sort of squirrely, she's also like singing to herself and
yes,
like going off on inscrutable tangents.
Yeah, she's falling to pieces.
So you definitely understand why Klemperer just thinks she's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because it shows you what the academy does to people. It sort of reduces them to this state. And I like that it's front-loaded here because it's sort of a harbinger of things to come. So Klemperer becomes a main player here, a key player. He spends a lot of the movie investigating the academy, trying to get answers, trying to get to the bottom of things. And that is a new addition. That's part of it's part of what makes the new one 2.5 hours long. Although, as I said, it went by relatively quickly. I think it was Alfred Hitchcock who said that you don't want the audience ever thinking about how their ass is sore, you know?
Yeah.
I never thought about how my ass was sore.
After we see Patricia go to Klemperer's office and she's clearly losing it, we get introduced to Susie Banyan, the protagonist played by Dakota Johnson,
mm-hmm.
who is apparently untrained, like no official,
no formal training.
Dance training, no references, but she has managed to snag herself an audition at this prestigious dance academy run by Helena Marcos, or at least ostensibly, although we don't really see a lot of Helena Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
But she gets in and she auditions, sort of a very Black Swan vibe.
Yes.
Very it's not gentle dancing.
No.
it's very
rough. It's physically arduous and also psychologically fraught.
Yes.
So yeah, the Black Swan comparison is apt.
And initially, the sort of lead dancer, instructor, matron, if you will, Madame Blanc, played by Tilda Swinton,
mm-hmm.
Is not in the audition because they don't expect her to be good enough to bother her with that. They don't expect Dakota Johnson to be good enough, that is, Susie
yeah.
to be good enough. But she's sort of knocking their socks off. And Tilda Swinton comes in and sort of catches the end of the audition.
Having sensed her potential, it seems, from halfway across the academy, she just materializes in the room when no one's looking.
Which
is kind of the first whiff of paranormal happenings that we get.
Yeah, and I mean, again, the original Suspiria is rather more coy about there actually being witches in the academy. Mm-hmm. This Suspiria comes right out with it.
Right.
Not quite immediately, but very soon.
Well, it knows it's a remake, you know. I think it knows that fans of the original are going to know what's up.
So there's a lot of scenes relatively early on of the witches sort of gathered, and they're all the instructors, basically, mm-hmm. at the dance academy, and they're sort of gathered behind closed doors debating what to do.
Yeah, they've all got political agendas this time around. They're individuals. Which I think is that's another way in which the new political context of this remake inflects the characters and their relationships. There's all kinds of backroom wheeling and dealing in this one that wasn't in the original. The witches aren't just a homogenous entity anymore.
Right.
There's some backstabbing.
Yeah, and in fact, Madame Blanc is sort of the would-be leader of the alternative faction. Mm-hmm. And there's like a leadership election, basically.
Yeah.
Relatively early on, which she narrowly loses to Marcos.
Who I guess is the incumbent.
Right. It's a margin of about... I think,
for God knows how long.
Right. It's a margin of 3 votes, and that's with Madame Blanc abstaining, so really mm-hmm. 2. But yeah, so there's a lot of intrigue even amongst the coven, which sort of adds a new level. But anyway, so after this very successful audition, obviously Susie is invited to join the dance group, the company.
Mm-hmm.
And then next, she's sort of packing up her things at her hotel. We get introduced to Sarah, who's this sort of very friendly, welcoming member of the dance troupe.
Yeah, their initial interactions are very Hogwartsy. It's very like, oh, you're gonna love it here. We're roommates. Yay. Sarah seems completely clueless.
Almost to the point where I was afraid for a good chunk of the movie that she might be in on the scheme,
mm-hmm.
On the machinations of the witches. You know, she might be a witch herself.
Or that she would just be like some kind of guileless sap, just a babe in the woods, which is, you know, would also be kind of a waste. But
neither of those turns out to be the case.
No, the movie really throws you a curveball at you on that one.
Yeah,
Susie turns out to be pretty resourceful. Sarah, I mean, yeah. Susie. Well, Susie also turns out to be pretty resourceful.
But we'll get to that.
Yes.
Boy,
will we.
So, they end up crashing in the hotel room for reasons that are important, but the next day they're back at the academy and they're practicing, rehearsing for this big dance they've been rehearsing for months and months. Apparently it's one that the company has done at various intervals for quite some time,
which I expect has some occult significance.
Yes.
Like they're literally doing it ritualistically, which comes into play later on.
Yeah, and it's called Volk, or Folk, depending on how accurate your German pronunciation is. It's spelled with a V, but it's kind of fudged between a V and an F.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically means folk in English, so there you go.
English
is a Germanic language, fun fact.
Jim's here with the etymological roots of foreign words, and I just mispronounce names. Makes me look like a real rube by comparison. Although he did screw up the Latin for darkness earlier, so we're kind of...
Much screw up as gave up.
Yeah. But, oh. yeah.
In any case, they're rehearsing this, and Tilda Swinton's message to Susie is just like, well, you know, I understand you're just starting off. You don't feel the need to jump in right away.
She jumps in right away. Well, she senses an opening because the lead dancer has something of a nervous breakdown.
And the lead dancer, whose name is Olga, has taken over from Patricia, who has disappeared.
Yes.
And that's part of the reason why she has this breakdown. Number one, mm-hmm. it's just very difficult and she's very stressed. But also, she's...
The jig really, is up.
She's, yeah, really worried and upset about Patricia. And she struggles for a bit and then basically just calls out Madame Blanc and says, you know more than you're letting on. And this is all shit and I'm leaving. So she tries to leave, and for reasons that aren't quite clear, ends up in this completely mirrored room. Like, all the walls, maybe the ceiling. I don't think we really see the ceiling, but it's all mirrors. And she's just sort of trapped in there. And what begins to happen, this is really the first, like, outright horrifying thing that happens in this movie.
Yeah, it's also the first big horror set piece, for sure.
And it's really the only one for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is Susie, after having been given a sort of magical touch on her feet and on her hands
by
Tilda Swinton, starts doing the lead role in this dance.
Perfectly,
or you know, damn near, whatever.
Yeah, and she claims to have studied it in an informal setting. You know, she's reviewed the tapes and, like, gone to the shows, but... Again, no formal background, so she's really got a lot to prove.
Yeah. And as she's doing the dance, Olga, trapped in this mirrored room, is being bent into increasingly unnatural shapes.
Yeah, if you've ever seen an Exorcist movie, kind of a rote
exorcism movie where the possessed girl is played by a contortionist. Imagine that, but pushed to the most uncomfortable imaginable degree. Like, it really makes all of those movies look very toothless by comparison.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a contortionist act where you feel like your arm's about to pop out of its socket and your ribs are getting broken and displaced. Like, it really sucks to watch.
Yeah, because it's not just like, oh, her arms are like bent behind her back at an unnatural angle. It looks as though part of her rib cage is distended at one point, and then it goes so far as to,
she's like, definitely got some bruising and internal bleeding happening. You can see like some stomach bloat. It's like really anatomically, medically precise in a way that made me feel distinctly uncomfortable.
To the point where her skull gets deformed.
Yeah, yeah, her face gets distended in a strange way.
That's really what freaks me out. It gets to the end of this, and she's basically just like a heap on the floor.
And she's still alive.
And she's still fucking alive.
Oh, no.
But real quick, it goes back up to Susie having like had to stop, basically, because I guess she's getting some feedback.
Yeah, she starts getting nauseous, as was I, incidentally. Right. So that's a little bit of an empathetic audience protagonist relationship.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say,
well done, filmmaker.
Susie says something along the lines of, you know, I was trying not to throw up on your dance floor. And I just thought, funny you should mention that. I was trying not to throw up on the floor of this movie theater.
Yeah.
So
that's an MJR. No one would notice or care.
Shots fired.
What can I say? It's, you know.
But, no. So, yeah, Olga's still fucking alive, and not just, like, for a few seconds either, because that's what I figured. No, because it goes back to her, and the witches go down there, and they're trying to figure out what to do with her. And so they pick her up with a bunch of, basically, like, big meat hooks.
Mm-hmm.
And while saying things like, don't hurt her, which is ludicrous, absolutely fucking ludicrous. But they pick her up with these meat hooks and they carry her off to God knows where. Well, I mean,
yeah,
we find out.
They drag her into a secret chamber and then the door slides shut and you're content to not follow because nothing good could possibly happen down there.
Right. Anyhow.
Reminded me of like the original Texas Chainsaw when Leatherface claims his first victim and then slams the door. You know, and you're like, yeah, good. That's I'll leave you to it then.
Yeah, I don't need to see any of that. No, thank you.
Yeah.
So then we get to basically it's Susie's first weekend, and so she and Sarah get into a little bit of mischief. They basically break into the office, and they're trying to find a file on Patricia and on Olga, for that matter, and they can't find either one.
Because her absence has not gone unnoticed by her peers.
Yeah, and Sarah's like at least trying to find a phone number for Olga's family to make sure she made it home okay, or if she didn't get confirmation of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's around this time that a couple of detectives show up at the academy because Klemperer has gone to the police to say, hey, this young woman, Patricia, who I've been counseling, has gone missing.
Mm-hmm.
So they come around asking questions and they get bewitched.
Yeah,
basically.
It's a very perfunctory investigation to begin with because they've got a lot on their plate with all kinds of Bader Meinhof shenanigans going on around the city. So they think that Klemperer is way out of his lane and they're just kind of humoring him.
Right.
And then on top on top of that, they get like bedeviled by the witches, and
one of them has his penis laughed at repeatedly by the witches because he's naked.
It's emasculating in the most up in your face way possible.
Yeah. And Sarah witnesses this also from like behind a shelf.
I thought they were gonna fucking castrate them for a second.
Well, yeah,
they had their hooks out and
no, that didn't end up happening.
Yeah.
And then Sarah just sort of runs back out and says to Susie, like, okay, well, yep, there's nothing back there, so let's go.
Mm-hmm.
Susie starts having these nightmares,
which you subsequently find out are being piped into her brain by Tilda Swinton and the other witches to condition her somehow and make her part of the tribe. The nightmares are genuinely unsettling. We complained in our first episode about how the nightmares in Slender Man are a little Marilyn Manson-y, you know, a little try hard.
Yeah, these ones do not have that problem.
No, these ones genuinely made me grind my teeth a little. It made me, you know, start clawing the armrests of my chair. There's some very off-putting imagery that you only see for a fraction of a second, just long enough for it to make an impression, and then it's gone.
Yeah. In addition to these sort of avant-garde, disjointed, but very alarming dreams, Susie is also having flashbacks of the way her mother died.
Mm-hmm.
It almost reminds me of, like, was it in a Mike Flanagan movie where, like, a kid grew to be afraid?
It's Before I Wake.
Yeah, it's Before I Wake. Grew to be afraid of a particular
boogeyman who
boogeyman.
Was... Yeah.
It was actually just like his mom with cancer.
Yeah, exactly.
And I kind of got vibes from that.
Yeah. And Mike Flanagan, as ever, is a major Stephen King devotee. That's an idea kind of from Pet Sematary. Mm-hmm. The wife in Pet Sematary is constant flashbacks to her sister, who I think had spinal meningitis. And she's looms large in her memory as a kind of horror monster boogeyman. Yeah. Kind of, you know, all twisted out of proportion.
Yeah, and so Susie's mother is got this basically perpetual death rattle sort of breathing.
Mm.
She's bedridden, and so that's just a recurring theme, and that goes in with, there's a lot of, you know, like sighing sound effects that go with, you know, Mother of Sighs, obviously. Oh,
yeah. The sound design in this movie is highly commendable.
Pretty top-notch.
We'll get to that later. Put a pin in it.
But in addition to the nightmares, they're also working on a new piece, a dance piece, where basically Tilda Swinton gives all the other dancers instructions and then tells Susie to wing it in the middle. Mm-hmm. Wants to see, you know, what her instincts are, so she's just improvising, and it's a lot of like scrambling on the floor, crawling work, basically.
Yeah, a lot of flailing, a lot of like, yeah, it's like the music video for Chandelier.
No. Yeah. During the improvising, Tilda Swinton is attempting to teach her how to jump, basically. Mm-hmm.
She's not getting enough air. She doesn't have those ups.
Yeah.
That Tilda Swinton wants to see.
And part of it's she doesn't have the muscle tone yet, but also part of it's she's not committed enough, not feeling it enough, basically. Mm-hmm. So
not fearless enough.
She's trying to push her to do it, and Susie's kind of not having it. In fact, she's trying to rationalize, like, staying on the ground.
Mm-hmm. They're having basically what amounts to an artistic disagreement, which is incredibly brazen, given that she's been there for all of a week.
Yeah, but clearly she's the golden child, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and this is one of many sequences in which the specter of World War II rears its ugly head. Tilda Swinton's mic drop moment has to do with how this piece is informed by lessons that they learned during the 40s, and how Susie doesn't know what she's talking about and needs to know her, you know, learn her place.
Right.
It's a sobering stuff. Tilda sells it really well. Tilda and I are also on a first name basis, obviously.
Obvi. So Madame Blanc tasks another dancer with showing Susie how it's done in terms of the ups department.
Yes.
So this dancer starts leaping very high, number one, and also mm-hmm. just very fearlessly and enthusiastically up and down.
Like a goddamn bullfrog.
Doing the thing.
And again, very black swan-y. Lots of quick close-up shots of like straining muscles, things like that.
Yeah.
It really makes you feel a little bit exhausted watching it in a good way. Well, in a way that's conducive to stress.
Right.
Which is fitting for a horror movie.
Exactly. And for reasons that aren't quite clear, this dancer gets a look from Tilda Swinton that, I guess, chills her to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, after the demonstration is done, the troupe is all kind of packing up and leaving the dance room. And then this dancer collapses and starts having a very dramatic seizure.
It's like, so well executed, because it looks like it's transitioning into the next scene. Like the camera, I wish that I had like a gif of it in front of me so I could see Because I remember the camera like starting to tilt away and then jerking back very abruptly just as this dancer goes into her conniption. It really pulled the rug out from under me. Because you expect there to be some payoff from that Tilda Swinton basilisk glare. But it happens so quickly. Really jarring.
Yeah. Now, as the troop is filing out, they come into contact with Dr. Klemperer, who has been kind of appearing intermittently throughout the movie at his country home and at his office, just trying to find out what's happened, trying to determine what's going on. And so he has shown up at the academy and is calling out to the dancers who are filing out to ask after Patricia, basically. He eventually addresses Sarah by name, and
the two of them get lunch.
At this point, Klemperer isn't quite firmly convinced that there's witchcraft going on,
mm-hmm.
but he's starting to be a little more inclined to believe it, and he's still, from the get-go, believed something nefarious has happened.
He's been leafing through Patricia's journals, I believe, which has given him more than ample reason to believe that the Academy is hiding something, and in particular that it has secret rooms in which bad shit is going down, which, you know, we already know for a fact. We, being the audience, were in something of a privileged position because we saw Olga being dragged into one of them.
Yeah. And
tangled, just like fucking human pretzel.
Yeah. Oof. Now, Sarah really doesn't want to believe something bad's going on at this stage, which is part of the reason why we expected her for a long time to be kind of guileless, although at this point I had definitely given up the idea that she was in on it. Mm-hmm. But I guess it did get under her skin a little bit, because after...
It planted a seed, for sure.
It planted a seed, but she leaves the professor behind, goes back to the academy, and then starts snooping around and finds the mirror room, and then finds a room full of murder artifacts, basically.
Mm-hmm. And different occult paraphernalia.
Deformed-looking statues, mm-hmm. etc.
It's a real scary room. I mean, that whole sequence, there's a handful of movies that have had this effect on me. It's like when Clarice Starling goes into Buffalo Bill's basement. This is like, in recent memory, I can't remember a movie that gave me such a visceral "don't go in there" feeling. You know, it's one of those like shouting at the screen moments, like,
no,
you know, no, don't go in the basement, you fool, or don't go in the attic, or where, you know, wherever the bad thing is hiding.
Yeah. It's around this time, it's actually, I think, intercut with this whole process, or if not that, slightly mm-hmm. before, where one of the witches...
Who hasn't, I think, said a single word the
entire
movie. Has just been looking lurking. Downcast and glum the entire movie.
I think her first appearance is when Susie initially arrives. She's up on a balcony sort of area,
and then she,
looking down.
Yeah, she's very furtive. Then she kind of capers off.
Yeah, but in the scene in question, the coven is meeting, as again they often do, and she just takes a kitchen knife and stabs herself twice,
like,
in
like
the throat.
Like a bolt of lightning. It just, like, it's so quick. Like, this movie can just turn on a dime like that, and the witches are taken aback. They're not, you know, they're pretty hardcore, but they didn't see that shit coming.
And they're wigging the fuck out.
Yeah.
And you sort of see the aftermath of this when Sarah's in the murder room, because she hears shouting from the other room.
It's some of Helena Marcos's subordinates explaining to her that this witch has taken her own life.
We didn't have the time to stop her. You know, it was too quick.
And I think that's the first time you hear Helena Marcos, although you don't see her.
Right. Thankfully, Sarah, at least at this point, escapes.
Yeah, she grabs one of the hooked implements and makes a run for it, which I took as like a self-defense gesture. She wanted to be in a position to fight back.
Yeah, and she goes and meets Klemperer again, and this time she's like, yeah, no, I'm on board. I believe you.
Yeah. Well, once he gets a look at that hook, it's like, okay, they're doing some meat work.
Yeah.
Down there.
So they're both on the same page now. And he tells her to find a place to stay and let me keep that hook. They shouldn't catch you with that hook. That would be bad for you.
Smart man.
So she hands it over, and he's later attempting to dispose of it, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Now it goes back to the academy where they're preparing for the evening's performance of the folk dance.
Yes, it's a hell of a production. I'm not going to dwell on it, but it's the dancing in this movie is really something else.
Yeah, no, it's very
frenetic, very, like, you fear for the dancers at times because they're just throwing themselves into the floor with a sound like it's like a slap across the face every time.
Yeah, and we keep talking about Black Swan, and Black Swan's no joke.
I think it outdoes Black Swan.
Black Swan's no joke, but this ups the ante from that, definitely.
Yeah.
Anyhow, yeah, they're preparing and they're all dressed in these sort of interesting BDSM rope outfits.
Yeah, kind of like stringy red garb. Sarah starts poking around again.
Yeah, like Sarah's nowhere to be found.
Scooby-Doo
Susie's
style.
Asking,
and then
asking for her.
This time she's not so fortunate. This time she's caught.
Yeah, it's one hell of a sequence, actually, because Klemperer's coming in because he's going to watch the performance. The dancers are all tittering nervously. The witches don't know where Sarah is, and they're kind of looking for her.
Mm-hmm.
She's creeping around in the underbelly of the building. She finds this spider web room.
Oh, Christ, yes.
If you haven't picked up on this from the first several episodes, Matt has a thing about spiders.
Yeah.
Not
a fan.
Not a fan.
They're instruments of the devil. They should all be destroyed. I just felt like I was invoking Muldoon. They should all be destroyed. That's his name, right? Muldoon?
Yeah.
The raptor man?
Yeah.
Give a girl.
anyhow.
Even problem-solving intelligence. Okay, that's quite enough of that.
Yeah, no, we could do this all day.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Sarah is looking around, and there's spider webs everywhere in this room, and she sees bodies sort of in these recesses in the walls.
Mm-hmm. She finds Patricia, who's not looking too hot. Looks like a bloated, waterlogged corpse.
Yeah.
Still alive, though.
Still alive, but clearly being, like, drained,
mm-hmm.
presumably by Marcos.
She thinks, or she sees, I think, Olga, who is now a multiple amputee.
And
hobbling around.
Still bent in all the wrong directions.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of a homunculus, really.
Yeah.
Crawling in her direction.
Which, again, harkens back to the fear of disfigurement.
Yeah. So this is what really causes Sarah to start fleeing through these underground vaults. She initially tries to get Patricia up to, like, get her out of there.
Yes,
that doesn't
really
work.
And that's when the holes in space-time swallow her.
I couldn't quite tell what was happening to the floor at first. The floor under her feet. It looked like blood was welling up through the floorboards.
Some kind of, or like oil, almost. Some kind of black ooze.
But as it turns out, those were just holes opening up in the floor.
Yeah, holes opening up in reality.
Right.
It looked like just a black void swallows her leg and...
Breaks it,
yeah. She has a bad fall and...
you know...
Like a bone through skin kind of fall.
Yeah, that kind of fall. And then... So she's obviously screaming in pain, as one should, and some of the witches come down, and they find her, and they pull her out, and they don't heal her leg. It's weird. They reseal her leg.
They give it a Band-Aid solution.
They seal the skin over the fragment of bone.
Yeah, exactly. They close up the wound without resetting the bone, and then they send her out to perform.
And yeah, she's,
to,
she's
to,
been
I guess, punish her for her insolence.
Sort of brainwashed.
Yeah, she's in a trance.
Her
trance.
Eyes look crazy.
Well, yeah, her eyes are looks like the only part that she still has control over. She's begging for help ocularly.
Yeah.
But the rest of her body is not under her dominion.
Yeah.
That's a brutal scene.
Yeah. She gets up there while the dance is happening. The dance is already well underway.
Yes.
She joins it partway through and she's just dancing on that fucking broken leg,
mm-hmm.
and it's brutal. And then she just keeps building and building and building, and finally she breaks through the skin again,
yep.
and she collapses and cries out, and obviously the audience is very perturbed.
Yeah, Klemperer makes a run for it, because the witches have been eyeing him. They can kind of sense that he's sniffing around.
So he flees.
And as you can probably deduce just based on the direction that this plot synopsis has taken, Sarah has kind of supplanted Susie as the protagonist at this stage. Well, yeah, that kind of ends now. But for the past several minutes, we've been saying Sarah does this, Sarah does that. Susie has basically kind of been absorbed into the company and into
the coven, yes, really, because
she's rising through the ranks with remarkable swiftness.
Yeah, Madame Blanc is definitely bringing her in. They even have like a telepathic conversation,
mm-hmm,
at one point in Susie's room.
Yeah, I said in the Slender Man episode, and I feel like reality has been out to get me ever since, karmically almost. I complained that the Slender Man movie couldn't pick a protagonist, and now our last two episodes, I've been at pains to point out that both this and Halloween also don't settle firmly on one protagonist, but they do it in ways that are intelligent and functional and, yes, keep you guessing.
Because to a certain extent, although less so, Klemperer is a protagonist of this film.
Yeah.
And that's through the whole thing.
Yes, it is.
So this dance has happened, and now we're not really sure what to expect. The first thing that happens is that Klemperer, he lost his wife in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's a Jewish gentleman, Klemperer. He has a menorah in the background in one scene in his office.
Yeah.
When he's talking to Sarah.
And they had been in hiding for a long time, and then eventually they got separated, and he hasn't seen her since, so figures she's most likely dead. But sort of out of nowhere, very suspiciously, mm-hmm, as she just sort of appears.
Yeah, she materializes at the cabin that they once shared.
And yeah, obviously he's overjoyed, and they just sort of go walking. Meanwhile,
she gives him what sounds like a pretty plausible explanation for where she's been and why she never tracked him down, because they both thought that the other was dead.
Yeah, and she like escaped to England, basically.
So it's a very sad, sweet reunion scene between these old lovers that really has no business being in a movie like this, but you go with it because Klimper's character is so well established, you know, and you feel for the guy.
But they're just sort of walking along, reminiscing, you know, enjoying each other's company for the first time in, you know, 35 years or however long it's been. And then gradually you start to notice that the area they're walking in looks awfully familiar. And then, mm-hmm, you realize they're right next to the academy.
Yep, it's the edifice it's the front entrance.
And Klemperer realizes this, looks at the academy, and then turns to look back at his long lost wife, and she's gone.
Yep.
She has dematerialized, and then he looks back to the academy. Two witches are running at him,
shrieking
like banshees. Like, I'm getting chills just thinking about it right now.
It's a terrible noise.
It's not an exaggeration.
No.
They drag him inside. Apparently, they've also retrieved the hook,
which he tried to dispose of in a river.
You know, they're complaining about how dirty he made it. Tilda Swinton has proposed during the intervening period that they add to their ritual a witness, which they decide is going to be Klemperer. And this ritual, it's not made immediately clear, but you kind of pick up on it gradually. It's basically that Helena Marcos, is going to have her consciousness transferred into Susie's body.
Yeah, she needs a new vessel every once in a while.
Yeah.
The one she's in now is pretty fucking decrepit.
Yeah.
Helena Marcos is hard to look at. Once you get a real good look at her in the final act of this movie, and she's genuinely grotesque in a way that, yeah, it's good stuff. She looks like something out of a Guillermo del Toro movie if he really ramped it up and went like full Lovecraft.
You know what? I thought of two things.
Okay.
And this is putting the cart before the horse a little bit, but I thought of two things. One, like Cronenberg, because it's very body horror sort of deformity.
Yeah, it looks like it could be like one of the aliens from Naked Lunch or something.
Or something that happened in Videodrome or
right.
What have
well,
you.
Well, yeah, because she does have like a gross little vestigial arm, like a baby arm almost, hanging off of her shoulder.
Yeah. It's,
and
it's
all kinds of like scabs and boils. She looks like a big bipedal toad,
and
basically.
I also thought of Slither.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very on point.
James Gunn pre-Marvel, if anybody's if anybody hasn't seen it, Slither is quite entertaining.
Yeah. But for you Lovecraft fans out there, it's like a perfectly realized fish person from Shadow over Innsmouth. It's like like a real like that thing has been breeding with Dagon, guaranteed. and her voice is gross. She's like glistening and corpulent and just vile.
Yeah. So it's clear that Madame Blanc has lots of misgivings about the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, among other reasons,
misgivings about Helena Marcos's leadership.
Well, yeah. In general, number one, she's kind of the alternative that's being put forward, but also she feels that. I mean, they tried the ritual first with Patricia, and she feels they rushed it, and they didn't have the right girl, and all these other reasons. Also, she's grown very fond of Susie to the point there's some implication of love there.
Yeah, maternal affection.
Yes.
Definitely.
And she's kind of dragging her heels, and finally she's presented with a fait accompli, basically. So this is where the movie really shifts into the end game. Everybody's down in the lowest vaults of the building, which just looks like a straight up dungeon.
It's just a pit of hell. Yeah.
And the dancers are all kind of, they're either dancing or they're in a human pyramid sort of looking thing. Madame Blanc is in this long flowing red gown. Helena Marcos is a fishy toad person, as we discussed.
Yep.
Glistening and gross, and really just a mass of indistinguishable flesh more than anything.
Yeah.
Also has the sort of like fish mouth almost. It's hard to look at.
Yes.
Susie is being brought in, and she's very serene for someone whose consciousness is supposed to be being wiped out any second.
She shows up and looks like the master of ceremonies, like she's completely in charge, and the whole scene kind of pivots on that idea.
Yeah.
That she's actually calling the shots here.
Yeah, and Tilda Swinton is desperately trying to give her an out, saying, like, something doesn't feel right here. If you have any misgivings about this at all, I can wipe your memories and set you free, and you can go on with your life. Just tell me. Just tell me that's what you want. Meanwhile, Klemperer has been stripped naked and has been sprawled out on the floor off to the side.
Wailing and protesting his innocence.
Yes, and The argument between Marcos and Madame Blanc escalates to the point where Marcos finally says, "You've been on the wrong side for far too long," and does this sort of Tai Chi almost maneuver until finally brings this arm stroke down and half decapitates Madame Blanc.
It's a Hellfest style half decapitation, which is worse than the full one, for those of you keeping track at home. It's really
spurting blood out the back of her neck, but apparently she's not quite dead.
It's a running theme in this movie, unfortunately. Things you look at a fate that a character has suffered and you think, oh well, at least their suffering is at an end now. It isn't.
It's not.
It never is.
Susie walks over to Helena Marcos, who is looking very excited, like, yay, I'm about to get this gorgeous and vibrant new body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just took out her main competition. And she's having a good day.
That's when it all comes crashing down.
This is when the movie goes full Mandy.
As
I believe I mentioned earlier.
Fucking bonkers. Mm-hmm. Helena Marcos, who has been claiming all along to be one of the three mothers, the mother of sighs specifically, Suspiriorum, Suspiria, turns out that she's a fraud.
Yeah, she's a powerful witch, obviously, because she just half decapitated someone from across the room.
Another fairly powerful witch.
With a dismissive wave of her hand. But she is not one of the three most powerful witches.
There's some implication that she was perhaps at one time prepared as a vessel for the Mother of Sighs, to the point where Susie asked her, like, for whom were you prepared or something.
Oh, that's
along
right.
Those
okay,
lines.
That makes sense. I wasn't quite sure what to make of that.
Helena Marcos is very clearly perturbed and like, yeah, the Mother of Sighs.
But like way wetter and grosser.
Well, sure, I can't pull it off.
I'm not even going to try.
And Susie says, I am she. And it's like, oh, fuck.
It's like if you imagine Harvey Fierstein choking on a bunch of seaweed. That is how I would describe it. A bunch of like soggy seaweed, kind of like with like a briny taste to it. I'm sorry, it sounds like I'm losing my mind here. It's because this movie did it to me.
Yes.
It took away what little sanity I had left. Because this last scene is fucking buck wild.
Yeah. Susie has revealed herself to be the real mother of size.
Mm-hmm. And she sets about proving it.
And this sort of black ghoul hair demon emerges from below the ground and goes around doing Susie's bidding, which is to say, murdering all of her opposition.
Yeah, everyone who voted for Marcos in the round of voting near the beginning of the movie.
Basically by making their heads explode.
Making their, just everything explode. They pop like greedy mosquitoes. It's a really dazzling display of viscera. They just turn into blood geysers and then crumple to the floor.
Helena Marcos just sort of melts. Blackens and melts.
Yeah.
Doesn't explode, is the only one that doesn't.
Yes.
And Susie, the mother of size, sort of tears open her own chest.
Oh, God, yeah.
To reveal, like, this sort of quivering, sighing mass inside. I thought she was just going to tear off her entire...
her flesh costume.
Yeah, flesh costume. As it turns out, she doesn't.
God, I forgot how... I forgot about that, and that's a crazy thing to forget about.
Yeah,
you know, like just, I must have just been reduced to a state of gibbering lunacy at that point. I must have been just sitting there in the theater going, you know, I can't imagine. I can't account for how, I don't know, that whole sequence just kind of hit me on a primal level. Like,
yeah,
just circumvented the logic chambers of my brain completely.
Yeah, I couldn't fucking handle it either. This sequence ends with the mother of size calling upon her remaining coven
disciples, her children, daughters,
to keep dancing. You know, it's beautiful, keep dancing. And then the film cuts to black, and then there's an epilogue where we go back to Klemperer, who's been released,
yeah, because, with his clothes, which was nice,
yeah, because he is supposed to be a witness, and he's back at home bedridden, and he receives a visit from Susie, the mother of size.
Mm-hmm.
Full name.
Yes. That's what it says on her business cards.
Yes. And she basically says, I didn't want that to happen to you. My daughters were responsible for that.
Yeah, a little overzealous.
I would have stopped it if I had been able, but I was prevented. And basically wipes his mind of all his troubles.
After telling him his wife's true fate, which kind of salves the wound of her being used as a lure several scenes earlier.
And as you might expect, she died in a
concentration camp.
Camp,
yeah, dies tragically. But at least Susie puts a kind of bittersweet spin on it. She affords him a clarity and an insight that could have only been arrived at by supernatural means. You know, she gives him closure. Closure, that's the word I'm looking for.
Yes.
And then she basically dementias him. She, like, Alzheimer's him, I think. That's the impression I got.
Yes.
From their last interaction, which I guess is more humane than killing him. That's debatable, I guess, if you've, you know, if you've known and, you know, had loved ones who were afflicted with that sort of thing. It's no picnic. So the movie ends on that note, which I think, if and when I revisit this thing, I think you kind of have to assess it as Klemperer's story, because it ends with the very final shot is the whole movie's been set in this kind of gray, wintry sort of environment. And then the last shot is looks like spring or summer. And new people have moved into the house where Klemperer and his wife lived.
Yeah, and it's just a very long zoom onto the heart with their initials inside of it.
Mm-hmm. Which is like a really, like... building. It ought to be a really schmaltzy way to end the movie. It actually reminded me of Call Me By Your Name. It looked like it belonged more in that movie than in this one. But again, since I was so invested in Klemperer and his story, you could go into almost any plot cul-de-sac with that guy, and I'd be here for it.
Yeah. Well, that was a long synopsis, but it was a 2.5-hour movie, so that happens. Yeah. Anyway, I think we'll go to our break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk about what we thought.
Yep.
Back in a moment.
At the beginning, she gave me things. Perfect balance. Perfect. perfect sleep. Oh, she wants to get inside of me. I can feel her. Oh, she can see me.
Hey guys, Jim here during the break to let you in on some ways you can help support our podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Got an idea for the next movie you'd like us to fix? Feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Three mothers, three gods, three devils. Mother Tenebrarum, Mother Lacrimarum, and Mother Suspiriorum. Darkness, tears, and sighs.
And we're back. So, Matt, what did you like about this movie? I know there's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot to cover. I mean, that plot synopsis took half of eternity, but there's, you know, a lot to unpack. There still is, incidentally. I kind of feel like we've only scratched the surface. First thing I want to do is sing Tilda Swinton's praises. We haven't addressed this yet, but she plays three roles in this movie. We identified her as playing Madame Blanc, but she also plays Professor Klemperer, an 80-something-year-old man. And she plays Helena Marcos, a, what, 500-year-old something woman fish? So
creature.
So impressive versatility, obviously. And really, the Klemperer performance kind of blew me away a little bit. It looked like a stunt at first. Like, you could just tell, oh, this is Tilda Swinton. It's not Uncanny Valley. It's not like dodgy CGI. It's very tactile and tangible. It looks like you could reach out and touch Klemperer's face and feel saggy old man skin. You know, if you like saw him on the street, you wouldn't think twice. He does look slightly androgynous at the beginning because you can tell that it's Tilda Swinton. But honestly, by the end of the movie, I just saw a sad, broken old man. Like, Tilda Swinton had completely disappeared. Yeah. So, you know, just shower that woman in Oscars. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think
it ought to.
It ought to. She's very good in this, all three performances, but Klemperer especially. What that character reminded me of more than anything was Father Marin in The Exorcist. They aged up Max von Sydow. They aged him up like 40 years for that role, and it does something in The Exorcist that this movie pulls off too, which I think it creates a kind of tension between what the movie is presenting as a kind of feeble elderly person, but then you see hints of the youth and strength underneath. It gives them a kind of weird subdued resiliency that I like, and that's true. The characters are they just have a lot in common. So yeah, that she's excellent. Klemperer is a great character. That's my main takeaway, frankly. And that his whole arc has surprisingly little to do with the kind of horror movie theatrics that you go into a movie like this wanting to see. I kind of, because I'd heard the press about how Tilda Swinton was playing a role in drag in this movie, I figured that it would just be a cameo thing. Kind of like Udo Kier is in the original Suspiria, but he just shows up for one scene.
And he's dubbed too, and which, is a crime.
Which is a travesty.
That voice, yes. Wasted.
Yeah, no, it's almost as galling as when they dubbed Jeff Goldblum for the Sentinel, which, again, they should be tried in The Hague for that one. And, you know, speaking of war crimes, I thought that the ghost of World War II hanging over this movie gave it a lot of doom and gloom that works wonders for its atmosphere. And Klemperer's whole backstory obviously plays a role in that too. I'm just so smitten with that character, man. I don't even know where to start. What about you?
Well, you know, I went into it not being sure what to expect, really. I mean, I liked Call Me By Your Name very much. But at the same time, you know, Suspiria is a classic.
Kind of a golden cow.
A horror landmark. And it doesn't matter who's remaking it. Fundamentally, it's a tall order. And I had heard, you know, mixed reviews. And I didn't know what to expect. Also, a friend of mine pointed out on Facebook, hey, why take a movie that was so vibrant and colorful like Suspiria and then reshoot it and make it look drab?
Because remakes should be different. This is something that I singled out for praise, like,
yeah,
at the beginning of this recording. They and I could not be more diametrically opposed on that score.
Well, right. And I came around basically to that line of thinking, which is, it's different, but it's still good, and it's good that it's different, because otherwise, why bother?
And it's just so fucking Soviet, too. Like,
yes,
you can't make a movie in this setting with that kind of neon giallo color palette. I mean, you could. I guess Atomic Blonde kind of did that, but that's a very different kettle of fish.
Yeah, and it's not quite the same color palette. It's more of a neon, almost Nick Reffin kind of color palette, anything.
Yeah.
Like Nick Reffin meets the 80s.
Right.
But yeah, so I ended up really liking how color worked in this movie. We touched on this briefly. The sound design is excellent.
From the very first scene, like when Patricia goes to Klimperer's abode and is bouncing off the walls, acting all squirrely, you hear just whisperings and murmurings in the audience. In the audience? Yeah, it sounded like it was coming from like the row behind me at times. That fucking movie theater surround sound is something else these days. I feel like an old man even pointing that out. But this movie utilizes it in a way that I haven't really heard in living memory. Like, it really felt like a peanut gallery of witches was kind of arrayed around you, tittering and making all kinds of breathy utterances.
Yeah. So sound design is great. Another thing that I really appreciated is that, at least at the beginning of the film, there's a lot of very giallo, Argento camera work. There's a lot of...
Yeah, it's really virtuosic at times.
Like, very abrupt zooms, in particular.
Argento's films, especially later in his career, Opera is one of my favorites for this reason, have a lot of what you'd consider, at least in like a Hollywood context, a lot of unmotivated camera movement. Like, the camera just kind of on a whim just flies off. And it's strapped to a pelican or something.
there was one shot in particular when Susie is like walking into the academy. I don't remember if it's the first time or when she comes back and gets welcomed in, but either way, the camera just like cranes up and away from her, like way the hell away from her, and it's very unexpected in a way that I really appreciated.
Yeah, the camera in this movie tends to be static for a long time, and then when it moves very quickly and erratically. You can't really predict what it's going to do from one second to the next.
Yeah.
But it kind of lulls you into a sense of stasis and then gives you a shock to the system. It kind of does that over and over again, but it never gets old.
No.
Lots of whip pans, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. The camera movement, as Matt said, it stays very unpredictable throughout the movie, but it's definitely in the beginning of the movie, particularly where, again, a lot of the whip pans, a lot of the abrupt, big zooms, whether in or out, that just really evoked the original without feeling cribbed. Felt like an homage, not a ripoff,
right?
In a way that I liked a lot.
And Luca, my good buddy Luca, is a huge fan of the original. Like, this was not a work for hire kind of thing. This is a passion project, and it shows, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So what else did you have there, Matt?
This is kind of a silly little observation, but the subtitles have a shading effect. They have like a red backdrop to them almost. Do you remember this? It's not Like they have like a kind of strange depth to them, a little bit of a three dimensionality.
Well, and not only that, but they change color.
They change color partway through the movie.
Well, it's not even consistent. It's like back and forth.
Oh, okay. I just remember it going from red to blue, but I guess it did.
It goes back to red sometimes.
All right, I just remember I was sitting there thinking like, God, even the subtitles are spooky in this movie. It reminded me of like how the inner titles in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari look like they were scrawled by a lunatic on a chalkboard. I like that the movie kind of slips under your defenses that way. It uses tools that most movies and most filmmakers don't even realize they have at their disposal. It just wouldn't occur to most directors to use the subtitles to make you uncomfortable. But yeah, I'm here for it.
Speaking of title cards, run our listeners through the title cards for the different acts.
Right. So this is, again, it's a long movie, longer than the original. And it's also from kind of an art house critical darling director. So it's got delusions of grandeur a little bit. And it announces this right off the bat. It bills itself on the title screen as like Suspiria. It's something like a tale of divided Berlin in six acts and an epilogue. Act 1, 1977. Act 2, Palaces of Tears. Act 3, Borrowing. Act 4, Taking. Act 5, In the Mutter House. Parenthetically, All the Floors Are Darkness. Act 6, Suspiriorum. Epilogue, A Sliced Up Pear. I feel like I should be getting finger snaps right now. Like I just went to a poetry reading or something.
Yeah, all the Floors Are Darkness is definitely my complete favorite.
I liked the depiction of the witches. I like that they're individualized this time around. They're kind of... So this is a weird point. So the movie goes out of its way to make sure that the witches are not just this monolithic evil this time around. Each one of them gets a vote. You know, they all have political agency, such as it is. And they, you know, as we've already mentioned, they bicker with one another. They disagree politically, ideologically with one another. They have different aims. And that's kind of feels like, how do I want to go about this? And it's sort of a tender subject. They occasionally come off like straw feminists a little bit. Like feminism has definitely informed this movie and its depiction of the witches. They're clearly women who have sought refuge in witchcraft and use it to protect themselves in a hostile world. Again, Tilda Swinton alludes to how they made it through World War II intact. It's mentioned at one point that the academy remained open all through Hitler's reign when, you know, the arts were direly underfunded and not a priority. Especially women-centric performance art was, you know, not something the Reich was super invested in. So the characters have, the witches specifically, have kind of feministic traits, but then sometimes when they rail against the male characters, they almost sound like caricatured, like feminazis, which is, you know, a very fraught word to use in this context, or in any context, but... Right. In this movie particularly, since the atrocities of World War II kind of linger around the edges of the frame.
That reminds me of near the beginning of the film, Susie has been admitted to the academy, and she's been informed of how the arrangement works. We can't afford to pay you very much, so we give you room and board. Dorms in here. And she's overjoyed about the fact that she doesn't have to pay to be there. And the woman... bringing her in says something along the lines of, we understand the importance of a woman having her own autonomy or autonomous income or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And you suspect even then, and it's definitely confirmed down the line, that autonomy is not their biggest priority, at least in terms of their student / sacrifice fodder's autonomy.
Yeah, so a lot of the like feminist jargon that's put in the mouths of the witches is fairly hypocritical, putting it kind of charitably. But they do land one real good kind of mic drop moment near the end of the movie when they're dragging Klemperer down into the dungeon. so that he can serve his role as witness. One of them levels an accusation at him, which I thought was, you know, fairly damning, where she says something like, Patricia came to you for help, but all the women in your life who tell you that something's gone terribly wrong, you don't believe them. You just say they're delusional or hysterical. That's somehow meant to reflect on his relationship with his wife, too. Like, maybe she wanted to get out of Germany sooner than he did, and he didn't listen. That's kind of the implication there, I think. So that, I thought, was a moment when the witches kind of misandrist, you know, when the witches' misandry was actually kind of a bullseye. But yeah, I bear in mind, none of this is a complaint.
I think it just goes to show that, yes, the witches are feminists so far as that goes, but to some extent,
they're
sort of window dressing, and fundamentally, they're there to use these women as food.
Right. They're what you'd call problematic, I think, in the parlance of our generation. And, you know, aren't we all?
Yes, well, true.
Just, again, on the way that the witches are depicted, this is in more kind of broader strokes. There's a lot of them giggling and cackling, really, like Halloween crones, you know, or like the villain in Snow White, which is such a like stock idea that it's not the kind of thing that I thought could ever scare me again. They don't ride broomsticks in this movie. That's basically the one thing they don't do. And they don't have like black cat familiars or anything like that. They're depicted more like the Satanists in Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
I think that's the closest analog, where they seem fairly down to earth. But when they cackle, boy, your blood runs cold. I don't know how they did it. They remind me of the witches in The Witches by Roald Dahl, specifically the film from the early 90s by Nicholas Roeg, which totally fucking traumatized me when I was a kid. There's just something about, like, when it's done right, The Witch from a couple years ago also did this very well. Just something about, like, I don't know, maybe it speaks to some primordial thing where we really all are just, like, have some kind of Hansel and Gretel fear that an evil old lady is going to come along and gobble us up. Like, maybe we never completely outgrow that, because if that fear is still in me, and I guess it must be, this movie tapped into it in a big way.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to just come right out and say, our thing with this podcast is supposed to be, we find what's wrong with a horror movie and we try and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to admit, we have been defeated in that quest by this film. This film is too good.
It's quite long. If there is fat on these bones, I haven't found it yet. A second viewing somewhere down the line might expose more flaws, but that's nitpicking, and I'm not above nitpicking. I mean, not remotely. That's kind of our métier. But I did not see a lot on a first viewing to take umbrage with.
No,
which isn't to say that it's perfect. It's just that I need more time to digest it, because, as I said, I think at the top of this recording, it's intimidatingly dense. There's just a lot going on here. In fact, I guess the one thing I would say is that some of the political baggage is slightly incoherent. Like, there's a lot of Klemperer, when he's naked, sprawled on the floor of the dungeon near the end of the movie, keeps saying, I'm innocent, or I'm not guilty. And there's a lot about innocence and guilt, and a lot of just kind of recurring mantras throughout this movie, not all of which get the kind of attention that I might have liked. I mean, I don't want this movie to be any longer, certainly, but I feel like it's very possible. I'm not advancing this as a negative or as a complaint, because I haven't ruled out the possibility that a second viewing might shed more light on some of that stuff. But there's just things like, we were kind of joking as we were driving back from the movie theater about how Jim pointed out, it's funny that both factions of this little witch civil war subplot, both factions are led by Tilda Swinton. You know, she's Helena Marcos and she's Madame Blanc. And I was like, yeah, man, it's like East and West Berlin, you know? They're the same. Which, like, I don't know if that was intentional at all. But this movie invites kind of pithy analysis like that because of all the new political dimensions that it takes on. And I have to say, the original did not have any of that. And so, in a sense, the original Suspiria is always going to be a simpler, purer horror film than that, than the new one, which I guess is, yeah. I mean, I still prefer the original, just, I mean, that's a criticism, kind of, if only by association.
I guess the one thing that did occur to me, and I don't know that this necessarily would have made it better, I'm not going to presume in this particular case, but one thing that I might have liked to see, particularly because we don't expect to see a trilogy emerge from this the original film, I would have liked to see a little bit more development of the mythos, in particular the three mothers themselves, and like how that mechanic works, and just fundamentally seeing all three of them in this film in some way, because obviously, you know, we see one because it turns out that Susie is the mother of size, so we see her, and it occurred to me, and this is by no means definitive, so this might not be the case.
No.
But the sort of blackened demon creature that makes everybody explode on Susie's behalf might be the Mother of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
But at minimum, we do not see the Mother of Tears, and possibly also the Mother of Darkness. And it's not necessarily a waste to have the three mothers stuff sort of introduced and then not fully carried off.
Yeah.
Quite that way, but I think it might constitute a missed opportunity. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see a little bit more of that.
It would be nice to get a good version of the Mother of Tears, which
we certainly do not have.
Atone for that now, yeah. I guess I would just say that the original Suspiria is always going to be just a visceral exercise in terror in a way that the new one can't be, because it invites all these political readings and it gets a little bit bogged down with all that stuff, at least in the aftermath. Like when you're pondering the movie and turning it over in your head, there's just a lot more to chew on. It's not a complaint by any means, but it does dilute the horror a little bit, I think. You know, it's not necessarily a movie that I could just pop in and watch on Halloween night.
Right.
You know, in the way that the original is. Like, the original is just like a classic horror movie. Very Halloween-y, very does what it says on the tin.
Yeah, I agree. But again, just to reemphasize, I think it dilutes the horror in retrospect.
Yeah, no, not during it. The movie
during, it's very visceral.
Yeah, yeah. No, I really don't want to undersell this. That final sequence is an orgy of blood. It's a fucking free-for-all.
In a way that, you know, sometimes an orgy of blood leaves no impact, but this is definitely super visceral and rather upsetting.
Yeah, really. It's a straight-up nightmare. They pull it off remarkably well.
Well, anyhow, you got anything else?
I don't think so. I've got more, like, kind of asinine, like, like, political interpretations, but I'm not going to get sidetracked with any of those.
All right, well. Looks like we've wrapped this up, so this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast.
Boy, has it.
I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we will see you next time.
Auf Wiedersehen.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Conner. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Suspiria, official trailer, Amazon Studios, uploaded by Amazon Studios. All rights reserved. Our next episode discussing the Nazi zombie flick Overlord will be up on Sunday, November 25th. See you then.